The Anton Savage Show with Kearies.ie on News Talk.
Obviously, an awful lot of coverage in relation to Fianna Fáil, it being the Ard Fhéidh over the weekend, and the possibilities of there being a Fianna Fáil, rather there being a giveaway budget. Because front page of the Sunday Times, Martin calls for €10 boost to child benefit. Business Post, squeezed middle promised tax cuts by Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil. And Sunday Independent, their off lead, McGrath pledges increase in pension, which is the sort of the headlines across the print edition of the papers. The headline, of course, in the online editions, well, that's radically different because of what happened overnight. Irish Independent Online, booms and sirens in Israel after Iran launches more than 300 missiles and drones in unprecedented attack. The Irish Times, Iran attack on Israel, 99% of 300 drones and missiles shot down, says Israeli military. New York Times, US intercepts dozens of Iranian drones and missiles aimed at Israel. And The Guardian, Iran warns of larger attack on Israel if it retaliates against drone and missile strikes. This, of course, is the news that you heard there from Ellen Butler, that more than 300 drones, ballistic missiles and crewed missiles were fired from Iranian soil into Iran, or rather into Israel overnight. The Israeli military saying that 99% of them shot down by Israel's Iron Dome air defences, facilitated by the US military, though some of them that did get through did cause injuries and damage. And of course, the question is now, what does this mean for tension in the Middle East? No one better place to answer that question than Alistair Bunkle. He is Sky News Middle East correspondent and he joins us from Jerusalem. Good morning, Alistair.
Good morning.
Can you first of all take us through what happened in relation to the drone strikes and the missile strikes?
So late last night, Iran launched a number of waves of attacks against Israel, not just emanating from Iran itself, but also Lebanon, Yemen and Iraq. The first wave was hundreds of drones. Then that was followed up by cruise missiles and ballistic missiles. According to the Israeli military, in a morning update, they believe, acting with their partners, the British and the Americans, they believe they shot down around 99% of everything that was fired towards Israel. They say that not a single drone actually made it into Israeli airspace. They intercepted them before they got here. But around 120 ballistic missiles were fired at Israel. One of them did strike a military base, an air base in the Negev desert in the south, doing some damage, but not too significant. And in terms of casualties, was one young child, a 10-year-old, who was quite seriously wounded from shrapnel, but that is the only recorded injury.
Iran is characterizing this as a retaliatory strike.
It is in retaliation for Israel carrying out an airstrike against the Iranian consulate in Damascus on the 1st of April. And in that strike, Israel killed 7 Iranian military officers, army officers from the Revolutionary Guard, including a very senior commander, a general who was Iran's links, or major high-level links with Hezbollah, the Lebanese militant group. They took him out, they killed him, and what was significant about that was that it was, although the Israelis deny this, it was on consulate soil. So that is effectively on Iranian sovereign land. And so that is why we've seen this response, a very big response, bigger than I think most people were expecting.
Obviously, a lot of the drones and missiles were intercepted by Israeli air defenses. There are reports that the US is saying that their military was significant in contributing to taking out some of the drones and to some of the missiles. What's the significance of A, the American military intervention, and B, their eagerness to claim credit?
Well, it was American and British, and they had been prepared for it. The head of CENTCOM, US CENTCOM, was in the country to coordinate what a response might look like if Iran did fire on Israel. And the RAF had moved extra jets to RAF Akrotiri off Cyprus, again, in anticipation of it. So there was coordination between those three militaries. The other thing I think is significant, and we don't know the full detail about this yet, and it is a sort of, on one sense, it's a side issue, but on the other sense, particularly for someone who lives and reports in the region, it is quite major. And that is to what extent Arab countries were cooperating with Israel, whether that is diplomatically, whether that's intelligence sharing, whether that's just clearing your airspace to allow either Israeli, British or American jets through it. You know, any of those levels. The fact is I think it is quite evident that a number of Arab countries, possibly Jordan, possibly the UAE, Saudi Arabia, etc., were giving some help here. And that, you know, in an area, in a region where Israel has so often been alone, that goes to show that, you know, things have changed here.
What does therefore it mean for tensions in the region?
It means that things have gone up a number of notches overnight. What happens next depends on Israel. The Iranians say that they're done. That what happened last night was their retaliation, their revenge for the killing of their officers, their military officers in Damascus. We'll wait and see whether or not, you know, that is the case, whether they are done. But I think more importantly is, does Israel leave it at that or do they retaliate? Now, there's a logic to say, leave it at that. You took out senior Iranian commander. You effectively, you know, violated a sort of an international agreement by targeting consular land in a foreign city. You know, that's your success. You got your scalp. And in return, you managed to fend off a major attack by shooting down all the drones and missiles that were fired at you. But as someone put it to me this morning, you know, you don't, you know, you still seek revenge on someone who tries to burn down your house, even if you were ready there with the hose to put out the flames. And it might be that the Israeli government decide they need to restore deterrence and they need to send a very clear message back to Iran. And if we go into that kind of territory, we really do start to slide down the scale and towards potential all-out war.
And when you say where they might retaliate on Iran, that means a direct attack on Iranian territory, does it?
No, I wouldn't say necessarily. There are other options. I mean, one option could be, and look, I'd have to stress, we are into the bounds now of speculation, but it could be maybe an invasion of southern Lebanon. Now, that is something that's been on the cards over the last 6 months because Hezbollah have forces right on the Israeli border, and that has resulted in about 100,000, 80,000 to 100,000 Israelis having to evacuate from the villages around there because they are worried that Hezbollah will do a Hamas-style attack. And so what we've seen over the last 6 months is regular fire between the two sides. Israelis have struck a lot of Hezbollah sites in southern Lebanon. I mean, we're talking thousands of rockets and missiles from either side. And you've always had, bubbling in the background, the potential for an Israeli land invasion of southern Lebanon in order to decisively push back Hezbollah. That they've stayed away from doing it, whether it's through international diplomacy or because they've just not decided the time is right or it wouldn't be the right thing to do. Okay, if you were looking to hit back at Iran now, maybe that's one of the options you're going to consider. Don't go for Iran directly, but go for one of their major proxies.
Finally, Alistair, that we've heard audio of the missiles exploding in the air. We've heard audio of the air raid sirens in and around Israel. You sit now in Jerusalem, what has the reaction been on the ground? What's the reaction among the people?
Well, I don't think many people got much sleep last night because, of course, the Iranian attack was telegraphed. We knew it was coming. Whether or not it's because the Iranians had forewarned the Americans, you know, it's just, which happens. You saw Joe Biden return from his weekend getaway back to the White House. Benjamin Netanyahu went down to the Ministry of Defense in Tel Aviv. So people knew it was coming. And that in and of itself is pretty frightening, knowing that you've got hundreds of drones and missiles on their way, but not knowing where they're going to be targeting, not knowing where they're going to be landing, not knowing where they're going to be shot out of the sky. So I think most people had a pretty late night and not a lot of sleep. This morning, it's quiet in Jerusalem for sure. I'm just looking out at the streets now, looking into the old city, and you know, there's cars on the road, there's buses on the road, but it's pretty quiet. Schools are closed today and tomorrow. Gatherings have been limited in size. I think everybody waits and sees. It's been a really tough 6 months here for all sides, for Israelis and Palestinians. But you know, this adds a slightly different layer to it. It was definitely a bigger strike on Israel than I think almost anybody expected.
everyone will breathe a sigh of relief that there was no fatalities, that really none of the missiles really landed and did much damage. But everyone will know that this is not necessarily the end of it.
Alistair, thank you very much. That's Alistair Bunkle there, Sky News Middle East correspondent, reporting for reporting from Jerusalem. And what Alistair was saying there about the questions as to escalation, the Jordanian government saying that regional escalation must be avoided. They've tweeted that only a couple of minutes ago. I'm joined by Hugh O'Connell, Sunday Times political editor, by Maria Walsh, MEP for Fine Gael, and Brendan Ogle, trade unionist, activist and social commentator. The one thing I suspect in all of this, Hugh, is so far Netanyahu particularly and Israel more generally have not been known for their restraint in response. So you wonder, will the Jordanian calls for such restraint fall on deaf ears?
Well, I guess that has to be the calculation that Netanyahu and his government has to make now. I mean, they would have known, I suspect, that when they carried out this attack on the consulate in Syria, I guess a week, 10 days ago, that there would be consequences, that Iran would retaliate. You know, some analysts are kind of predicting that there might be some tit-for-tat over the next few weeks, so that Israel will now carry out strikes on Iranian defense bases. I think there's up to 10 of those potential as potential targets. Or, you know, they might hit some government buildings or that kind of thing. They could carry out strikes on the Revolutionary Guard headquarters or some of its bases around Iran. So this could go on for a few days or a few weeks with kind of retaliatory strikes back and forth. And then at some point, both sides might decide that's enough of that. Or all-out war, which is obviously...
Which is a horrifying prospect because it goes, Maria Walsh, to the thing of the role of particularly, I mean, Alistair was talking about the British role in this, the British and US particularly, their role in this, because if you do get more and more conflict between Iran and Israel, it raises questions about those commitments of US support, what that translates it to, and who else gets drawn into this.
Well, to your point that you made at the outset, I mean, Israel knows no restraint and doesn't know how to de-escalate an already escalated situation. I mean, we're, 190 days post October 7th, and there's bloodshed all across Gaza, and it's always innocent lives, particularly women and
children.
Although,
to quote Alistair Bunkle's line about you, the fact that you managed to have fire brigade available doesn't mean you're not angry at the people who tried to burn down your house. You can understand how retaliation might be at the forefront of their thinking if they've just had 300 rockets and missiles fired at them.
Absolutely. But I don't agree with war in this particular part of the world infests more war, and that's what's terrifying. And that escalation is certainly not rolling back. That entire region needs to de-escalate. And sadly, and to your point, the US, UK, and I would challenge even EU leaders need to start speaking very clearly and working together on the de-escalation and calling it out. Now, how that rolls out when you're Netanyahu and not really listening to friends or allies, then it's a terrifying future that we certainly need to stop.
Yeah, I mean, I was just going to say as well that this does not fit the pattern of previous Iranian responses to. I mean, this is not the first time that Israel has carried out a covert operation in a foreign territory. You know, it's got decades of experience of doing that. But this is the first time I think that Iran has been so overt in its retaliation. I mean, normally you're a covert operation or they rely on one of their proxies in the region to do something there. In this instance, it's firing hundreds of rockets directly at Israel.
Although I assume they will say they had the imprimatur to do so by virtue of the fact that it
absolutely,
was technically Iranian soil a consulate that was attacked.
You know, they can argue justification. And just, sorry, the last point before you bring Brendan in, in terms of all-out war, I mean, that is not something I don't think that either side would obviously welcome, but also from a kind of a strategic point of view and from a resources point of view, like Iran's military, I think, you know, from reading around it this morning, is quite crippled. Western sanctions have had a huge impact there. And Israel is pretty stretched as it is, you know, is fighting lots of wars in that region and certainly, or, you know, putting up defences in large parts of that region. So, I don't think that strategically it might be the best course of action.
Well, that's echoed by some of the texts coming in. If we assume from previous attacks by Hamas that the system can be overwhelmed, was the attack by Iran simply theatrics? The number of drones and missiles taken out seems very high. Yeah, and there seems to have been quite a lot of advance notice that the attack was coming. But does that suggest that Iran more or less wants to say, we have done that, now let's all call it quits?
Well, what struck me about the news this morning, it's a pity the people of Gaza don't have a dome protecting them from Netanyahu's genocidal regime.
Just sit in on that mic a little bit,
Over
Brendan.
The last number of months. And thank God, apart from I think one child is badly injured, thank God there are no major human lives lost or no human lives lost as a result of last night's carry-on. And, you know, the horrors that are taking place in Palestine, Iran, a horrendous regime in its own right, is not the answer. I think that the political reality here is this is about Netanyahu. Netanyahu ran out a road, diplomatic and political road, with the White House, with Washington, even with the European Union, with many of his allies, in terms of his persecution of the Palestinian people a number of weeks ago. And I think now...
By God, for a man who ran out of road, he seems to still be getting a lot of support.
He ran out of diplomatic road, and I was very, very clear with the White House. But now he's getting support now because he's managed to lure Iran. He's managed to pivot his behaviour in Palestine into a dispute with Iran, and Iran have now responded. And, of course, the White House are now coming out on their white charger again behind Netanyahu. So this is about maintaining Netanyahu in power. And unfortunately, the lesson of the last 6 months is that there are no numbers of innocent human lives that he will stop at to protect his own skin. And I think that's what we really need to worry about.
I should say that the British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has condemned what he's describing as a reckless attack. And he says that he and Britain needs to now work with allies in the region to stabilise the region. And quotes, nobody wants any more bloodshed. If you want to get in touch, 53106 at a cost of 30 cent or 087-1400-106. I'm joined by Brendan Ogle, trade unionist, activist and social commentator, Maria Walsh, MEP for Fine Gael, and Hugh O'Connell, freshly minted as political editor of the Sunday Times. How's the new gig going, by the way?
Fine so far.
Fine so far.
I picked a week to start.
Didn't you just?
Plenty of politics happening in the last few days.
Well, fortuitously, you are splashed all the way across the front page of your own paper with a breakdown of the various different promises. Santa is coming for all of us, it looks like, from the way that you're reporting it on the front of the Sunday Times. Martin calling for €10 boost to child benefit. We'll get into all of that which has been promised at the Fianna Fáil Ardéis and where we stand politically. The Middle Eastern political and military situation, says the text, is a horrific mess, has been for decades and will be for decades. It is definitely worthy of news coverage and geopolitical input. However, it's not going to be sorted in the lifetime of anyone over 50. Meanwhile, I believe most of Europe's political and financial attention should be devoted urgently to stopping Putin in Ukraine. This can be sorted in our lifetime if given the attention and aid required by all European nations, and anyone else who wants to help. Ukraine should be Europe's urgent primary concern, in my opinion. As I say, if you want to get in touch, 53106. Let's turn to domestic matters with the new political editor of the Sunday Times. Front page, Hugh O'Connell, you're breaking down the pledges that we are likely to be in for coming up on the next budget. And it's not a huge windfall, but it's a windfall.
Yeah, well, like every year, budget season seems to kick off earlier and earlier. I mean, it was around May last year. And this year, Micheál Martin, in an attempt, I think, to regain the political control of the political agenda from Fine Gael, which has spent the last 3 weeks obsessing about itself, is talking about what Fianna Fáil is looking for in the budget this October. And chief among them, things like a €10 boost to child benefit, bringing it up to €150 per month per child, which would be the first increase in child benefit in nearly a decade. And would be very popular. It's a payment paid in respect.
And given the inflation over that decade,
he talks about that, it being a catch up. And then there are kind of broader commitments around childcare, further reductions in childcare fees, and a sort of a longer term commitment to universal free childcare, which all of which feeds into this idea that we're now firmly entering into election season, not just the local and Europeans coming up in June, but, you know, the three coalition parties are very conscious of the need to start talking about what they would do if they were re-elected after the next general election.
And the other one is the tax credit shift, wasn't there? Sorry, an increase. McGrath talking about shifting the bounds.
In terms of the entry point for the tax, lower rate of income tax, the standard rate of income tax, that increasing to 20,000. So in effect, the first 20,000 euro of a person's income would be exempt from income tax. And that is interesting in terms of that's what Fianna Fáil is talking about, whereas Fine Gael is talking about increasing the threshold at which the higher rate applies up to 50,000. They won't do that in this budget, but they want to do that in the long term. And I think that is reflective of the differing priorities of those two parties.
Does this stuff work? Does that kind of one for everybody in the audience coming up on a budget, does it actually impact on the ballot box?
I don't think so. I mean, like, I've been covering politics for over a decade now, and in that time, I have never seen a budget dividend for the incumbent government. Fine Gael, Labour.
There isn't a bounce, no matter what they give away.
Well, not the evidence that I've seen over the years is not. I mean, I remember Fine Gael Labour coalition, which imposed swingeing austerity, which was enormously damaging to some of the most vulnerable groups in the country in some instances, and I'm sure Brendan would have lots of views on that, introduced two expansionary budgets, from a very low base in the run to the 2016 election, unceremoniously dumped out of office. Fine Gael clawed its way back to power as a minority government, but a series of giveaway budgets, one for everyone kind of budgets, did little by way of helping Fine Gael in that general election in 2020 when they lost 15 seats. So the evidence would suggest very much not. But nonetheless, these are the things that this government wants to do. And they hope that there will be some dividend when it comes to the general election.
Brendan Ogle, if the motivation is electoral, does that matter if the end result is positive for people's child benefit, for people on the state pension, for people who are on the lower wage?
Oh, God, what decade is it? I'm not going to answer your question. I'm going to tell you why I'm not going to answer your question. The cynicism of this is absolutely sickening and boring and dull and uninspiring, and everything that the body politic, main parties at least, and I'm going to talk about your interview yesterday, if I can.
Sure, this is Micheál Martin, ahead of the Ardèche, yes.
My wall at home is covered in coffee because I wasn't able to keep it in my mouth listening to Micheál Martin yesterday. You did an interview with him yesterday, and he told the listeners that about a half of the Dáil, didn't pick on people, and I'm not going to name parties. About a half of the Dáil were opposed. Listen to this now. Were opposed to trade and jobs. And he pulled you up because you didn't seem to think that was real or that was serious, and he pulled you up telling you how serious it was. And he cited...
Now, to clarify, this is a trade deal, a Canadian trade deal, that, indeed, and that it had been opposed.
The Canadian-European Trade Agreement as evidence of this. I have never met anyone in politics, from the left to the right to the centre, who is opposed to either trade or jobs. Nobody. I've never met a child who's opposed to toys, and I've never met a politician who's opposed to trade or jobs. And Micheál Martin presented CETA yesterday as evidence of this. He didn't tell your listeners that CETA has been subject to a judgment of the Supreme Court in November 2022. And that CETA cannot be instituted in this country because it has found to be unconstitutional by four of the seven judges who issued that judgment. Justices Hogan, Charlton, Dunn and Baker. And in fact, Justice Hogan...
Okay, well, steady, Brendan. I don't want to get too far into the weeds of the CETA trade deal. What point does it go to in relation to politics?
Because as Micheál Martin saying that four Supreme Court judges are also opposed to trade and jobs. This is a presentation of a man about to go to his Ardèche, leading a party that has been almost an effective perpetual power here for a century. And wherever we are, there's no party in Ireland more responsible for where we are. Wherever you are, all you listeners think that is, than Fianna Fáil. And now we've got elections coming up, and now we've got another general election coming up sometime in the next year that'll hang on for grim death to the last second until they can do that. And what are they doing? Oh, we'll give you more on your pension. We'll deal with childcare. We'll build more. Absolute cynicism.
But this returns to the question that you didn't want to answer at the first point. what's wrong? If the end result is positive, does it matter if the motivation is cynicism? If people are getting, if you get 20 grand before you get onto the paying any tax, is that not a good thing for people on lower wages? If you get an extra 12 quid on the child benefit or on the state pension, is that not a good thing for people who are in receipt of both?
Fianna Fáil are doing nothing about precarious work. Fianna Fáil are doing nothing about the ability of workers in this country to organise. Fianna Fáil are doing nothing about low paid. And as Hugh has pointed out there...
I mean, that's not true.
Well, it is true. It is
true. I mean, just on the last one, Fianna Fáil are doing nothing about low paid. I mean, if you increase tax credits to such an extent that the first €20,000 of your income is exempt from income tax, I mean, that is doing something. It may not be enough from your perspective,
but if you're talking about a labour market that is an effective Wild West, where we have a black market, where we have a huge burgeoning hospitality sector, where we have people Deliveroo, we prepare precarious employment, we don't have technically 0 hours contract, we people brought in on visas, we people brought in learning English, who are being abused, who are being bullied. We've modern day slavery in terms of some of the really precarious sectors of this economy, and nothing has been done about that. Fine Gael, did something about tip theft, and did something about that early. Leo Varadkar actually got his head around that. But the reality is, we have precarious work. We have a huge transfer since the crash of wealth from the bottom and the middle to the top. And to come along in an election cycle and say, we're going to fix this all in the next 6 months, they're not going to fix it in the next 6 months.
Marie Walsh?
No, I just wanted to come in because for me and why I love listening to Great Debate, I think it's also really important that who it does budgets really need to meet and support. And for me, it is around those with disabilities in terms of removal, any means tested, our carers, those who provide the care. To Hugh's point, in terms of that 20k tax break and then build up. I mean, that really is a welcomed move. I know from our side of the house, in terms of Fine Gael, I seen it reported in the newspaper in terms of Simon Harris beginning to bring in a working group within Fine Gael to deliver a tax strategy. We're going to see more of that, or hear more of that, no doubt, in the next weeks and months. You know, all of those increments certainly do help. While I'm with you on someone who graduated out of college in a recession with a father who was in the construction trade, I don't sit too nicely with Fianna Fáil in terms of the development of their budgets over the years. But I do believe we are certainly clawing back and making sure that those are supported. But of course, we have more to do within, as I mentioned, those with disabilities, and removing any sort of means test around them and our carers. Like, there are certain groups that we desperately need to support. To your point around precarious work. I worked really hard at the platform directive at an EU level through the employment committee, and sadly there wasn't an appetite across all the political houses from left and right, to your point. So that is where, in the next mandate at an EU level, we need to really challenge the bogus.
Brendan, you look unconvinced.
It's a strange position to be in. I attended a conference in the last few weeks of the European Trade Union Institute about the platform directive, which as Maria says, unfortunately, it didn't get over the line. I'm not convinced but I did make a point a few minutes ago. You know, actually, Leo Varadkar, not somebody that I would be, you know, renowned for praising in terms of political work.
Keep going, Brendan.
But he did focus on the hospitality sector, and he did initiate, against perhaps, you know, what I would have considered his party's ideology, he did initiate really, really fundamental reforms there. I don't see any evidence of Fianna Fáil doing this. I just don't see it. And I have to say, I can't take a leader seriously that sits
down...
Well,
they are part of the government that approved those measures.
I can't take a leader
Brendan.
Seriously that sits down and makes the comments about CETA that was made. I just can't take it seriously. It doesn't stack
well
up.
Can we go to the bigger issues that they all face, because the breakdown of those issues, again, there's a piece that Hugh has contributed to significantly around what faces the government and what Harris has achieved or hasn't achieved. The big issues as we now stand, things like housing, where on that, from what you saw yesterday, Hugh, do you see any prospect of that getting sorted? Because Simon Harris is telling us 50,000 houses, Micheál Martin is saying agwe, but we'll do our best.
Well, look, housing isn't going to be sorted by the next election. And the crisis that we've all been living in for the last 10 to 15 years, well, the last 10 years, I would say, probably 15 at this stage, certainly since the financial crisis, the situation that's facing a lot of young people at the moment in terms of exorbitant rents and the inability to get on the housing ladder, the inability to buy a house even when they've got good jobs and are earning decent money, that's not going to change before the next general election. It might improve a little bit. I mean, there is evidence that there are, like, and, you know, I'm very conscious that my peer group is not representative of wider society, but I have friends who are in a position to buy a house now that weren't a few years ago. So for some people, it is getting a bit better in the middle. But for lower income households and people on lower incomes, like, the prospect of ever owning a home is just, it's completely gone off the agenda. And it's a fundamental change in which Irish society has undergone as a result. There's a whole generation of people who'll never be able to buy their own home. And that's something that success.
That's an extraordinary thing to say, isn't it?
But it's true. I mean, it's completely true, and it's a thing that successive governments have been unable to fix. That contract is now sundered. It's broken, and I don't think any successor governments will, either on the left or the right, will necessarily be able to fix it. Certainly not in the short term.
Although Simon Harris says
maybe
they will.
Medium in the long term. Well, I don't. I mean, Simon Harris. I'll finish this point, Maria. Like, Simon Harris is not going to be able to achieve anything substantially game-changing in 10 months in office. That's the reality of it. He might be able to push things along incrementally. He might be able to, you know, do certain things that will...
So the 50,000 was a nice promise to make, knowing you never have to deliver.
We're all promising.
Well, he's promising. I think he's promising 250,000 homes over the next 5 years. That may well be achieved, but in terms of population growth...
I don't mean to lean too hard on this, but how?
Well, because, I mean, in fairness, you know, the number of homes being built every year has gone up.
But if you want 250 over 5 years, that means you have to average 50K a year. That means if you miss that 50K target year one, you're backloading another 15,000 onto year five.
That becomes
a challenge.
We can talk about how we're going to achieve, but in fairness, that's what he said. He didn't say it was going to be a kind of a consistent 50-50-50. He, you know, it was kind of building up to...
Well, Maria Walsh is here. You're Fine Gael. What's the how, Maria?
No, well, I think there's layers to it. I do think, in terms of his previous portfolio, in terms of apprenticeship and traineeships, scaling those, ensuring that we have more and more people of all ages looking into the development of our trade, that's incredibly important at one layer. I think our planning permission and the division of it needs to be absolutely thrown out the window and rebuilt, because it's simply not working. As someone who covers constituency of 15 counties, I can give you five towns I drove through yesterday.
But we're
in
talking
County
light
Mayo.
Switch stuff here. We're talking silver bullet.
I'm
we're talking immediate solutions.
Yeah, but
these are all
point.
Gradual incremental shifts that won't deliver 250,000 houses in 5 years.
Well, I was on Friday, I was in Ballybay in County Monaghan, and 53 derelict buildings were in that town. A task group came together, and over the course of 1 year, 10 of those homes came back into circulation. There is no reason why we're not escalating the change of derelict homes and making our small towns and villages more feasible and more attractive
but are
to
these
people
not
coming
what,
in.
Is this not what we have been hearing about these incremental shifts for the last 6 or 7 years? We have been told now that we are going to up our productivity in terms of house building by about 40% more or less overnight. Mm. How?
Building. I mean, getting more people looking into the building trade, getting people looking into anybody who's sitting on a dereliction property after a period of time needs to either build it or get off it. Like, there's absolutely forms of... Sorry, Brendan you're desperately to come through.
The point about derelict buildings is absolutely right. There are I think 160,000, an atrocious number of derelict buildings, and there needs to be punitive taxes to get those buildings back into use. But unless the only government that will deal with this will be the first government to break with the ideology that has created this. And the ideology that has created this is the state abandoning the provision of housing and homes. We need a massive public house building program, parallel and in competition with the private sector. We need to remove the profit motive, because basically what we have is a succession of governments now, and it'll be the next one as well, held captive by the building and landlord class, driving up costs, driving up taxes, driving up and driving down supply. Now, supply is increasing around 30,000 a year. Oh, I'm just reading the paper now. Conal Thomas says every party now is promising 50,000 a year. So they're just all matching each other now. That's not important. When the houses that I grew up in, the houses that loads of people listening to this show grew up in, were built by the state. So the state needs to set up, sort of like NAMA, a state building agency, and the state needs to resource
that. The only difficulty with that, though, Brendan, is you have less
difficulties with it. But
indeed, but you've vast amounts of capital that are flowing into the system. If you say, well, some of that capital will come from the state, it still has to end up in the pockets of brickies and chippies and sparks and all the people who can do the work.
Yes.
Where do they come from? Because do you not just suck them out of the private sector?
And there's no But when you say suck them out of the private sector, what sector are they in? They're in a bogus self-employed sector. That's what they're in.
Yeah.
So, listen, what we need to do...
Self-employment also serves its purpose there, Brendan.
You will say to skilled workers, we have jobs here with a state agency that are permanent jobs, that are taxed jobs, that are pensionable jobs, that have proper benefits. We've got proper jobs. We're not going to be treating you as bogus self-employed, which is a major tax rip-off, by the way. The money being lost to revenue by bogus self-employment could build the houses we need in this state to solve the problem. We'd need proper...
Where do you get the workers, though?
We get the workers from the construction sector, from people moving from this bogus self-employed into state building, into proper jobs. There used to be a situation in the past where tradesmen, tradeswomen were employed and had decent jobs. Now they're all being treated like they're little companies, and there's tens of millions in revenue.
Now this is touching a nerve. Maria Walsh, to bring you some of the text, Anton, nobody including Sinn Féin can fix the affordable housing issue, but the thing it needs is stop looking into it. Looking into building, stop looking into it. Fine Gael are a joke when it comes to housing. Maria has convinced me to vote Mary Lou number one.
Well, that's disappointing to hear. And hopefully over the next couple of other topics, I might bring you back into my view and my thinking. But, to Brendan's point, and I'm going to challenge you on this one. I grew up in a house where my father was a carpenter and built a very successful construction business. You talk about that industry as if they've created the problem. I mean, people who want to run their own businesses, like our SMEs right across the country, are deserving so if they want to do so. And our private sector is incredibly important in our building our businesses too. I do agree with you in terms of state production. I'll just finish this point. I talk to you about bogus self-employment in terms of construction. That's what you said.
The entire sector is built on bogus self-employment.
I argue that one. I don't agree with you on that one. To Anton's point in terms of getting more trade, we can't just pick from one or the other. I mean, we're going to be tapping into a growing population. We have to completely disregard the fact that you need to go to, and stealing our now Taoiseach's line, highbrow academics. We need people to start looking at apprenticeship and traineeships in our trade sectors in order to build these houses, which I do believe this government will deliver on.
Okay, there is much more that we need to discuss. Before we go to the ad break, one small question out of all of this. The politics of this, Hugh, given the pressures that there are in relation to being able to deliver on the various promises that we're getting from both government parties, what's the betting on when the election is? Willie O'Dea saying, should have gone early, go now.
Yeah, there's a bit of commentary in the papers today about this idea of going early, but I've always maintained that this coalition would go the full term. I think that theory is bolstered by the election of Simon Harris's Taoiseach. He won't want to relinquish the office of Taoiseach in 6 months. I think he'll try and get as long as possible out of it. Micheál Martin has given all indication that he favours that approach, so does Eamon Ryan. So in that instance, I think the coalition will go the full term, but the local and European elections, the outcome of those could change that dynamic.
Well, there's also interesting news on when we were talking about the changes to the budget, how all of this is going to get paid for, because the front of the Business Post is reporting Amazon and Google hitting out at high-risk data centre limits and raising questions about their foreign direct investment into this country, on which, of course, so much of our revenue is based. We will come back and discuss that after this break. I'm joined by Hugh O'Connell, Sunday Times political editor, Maria Walsh, Fine Gael MEP, and Brendan Ogle, trade unionist, activist and social commentator. And I assume, Brendan, you would have a view on Amazon and Google telling us, look, lads, the national grid effectively is not strong enough, reliable enough or easy enough to connect to for us to invest in the country the way that we want to. And therefore, you might look at the level of employment we may not be providing you.
They're threatening us.
Yes.
Yeah, okay. But that's what multinational corporations do.
Should we take the threat seriously? No, I should be clear. They themselves are not threatening us. We're being somewhat facetious. There is a representative body for the tech giants who have warned that Ireland, according to the Business Post, is likely to lose significant levels of investment because of our failure to address our creaking energy system.
Mm. Well, look at our creaking. I know a little bit about our energy system. And is it creaking? Is it not creaking? Certainly.
Of course, I forgot your ESB days back in the day.
Back in the day, yeah. With the proliferation of data centres, I think most that we have in this country, I think most energy systems would be creaking at this stage. There's a real issue about the proliferation of data centres that we have and energy security going forward. And you know, so if Amazon and Google are concerned, you know, I'm much more concerned really about the sustainability of our energy system and where we're going to get energy in the future in the first place. I think we need to have almost a moratorium on data centres at this stage. Almost 60% of the energy is going there. It's ridiculous. Now, look, we have to get investment into the country. We're very good at getting investment into the country, but we have to do so in a way that's sustainable. And I think
we've been good in providing effectively good customer service for a long time. We have said, what is it that you need? And let us make sure that we provide it as efficiently as we can. If we can't allow them to plug in, that's a huge problem, isn't it?
I think ESB and Airgrid do an amazing job for this country. And I'm not just saying that because I'm putting on the badge for my former colleagues. I really think there's a lot of things don't work well in this country. I think ESB and Airgrid do an amazing job for this country.
With what they have, but what the multinationals are saying, this isn't good enough to attract further investment.
It'll never be enough for every data centre that they want to put in Ireland. It'll never be enough. I'm much more interested in getting an energy system in this country that is sustainable going forward, that gives energy security to our citizens. And I think we're reaching a stage now where we have to look and say, how many more data centres do we need? I think that's what we're getting.
Mary Walsh, would you be concerned?
I would be concerned to pick up on some points there in terms of our energy security as an island nation, most west periphery of the EU. We need to get serious in terms of the speed of which we're building offshore. I'm not a fan of inland, particularly around residentials. I don't think it's fit for purpose, but offshore and the planning permission requirements for that. Also, our water use and we're by no means built for purpose there. And of course, to that previous point on housing, those three points, if we actually get serious about where we're going in the future as an island, and we are that powerful island if we get our renewables sorted,
we could really be game changers
across Europe.
It didn't creep up on us. We knew we didn't have the capacity to provide clean water in bulk to FDI. We knew we were running out of grid capacity. We didn't do a lot about it.
Well, we have historic structures that we need to change. I mean, we also have developed more and more housing over the past 20, 30 years on septics and water systems that are not fit for purpose. So we do have an awful lot of cleanup to do on that sense, not taking away from there.
The grid is constantly being renewed. Constantly.
But you have a situation where you have big FDI saying it is insufficiently capable to plug in. Last year, we were speaking on this programme to both grid energy providers and grid management, who were saying we may be in a situation where we're facing brownouts and possibly blackouts because we are at the outer edges of what the grid can cope with.
Okay, well, thanks very much for your opinion.
Will you move it on the mic a bit?
We take it on board, and if we're going to be brownouts and blackouts, let's brown out and blackout a couple of data centres and make sure the citizens of this country have safe, clean, secure, sustainable energy.
But to that point, we shouldn't be just placating to larger companies. I mean, we also, when we talk about infrastructure, it's also having single-use homes or residentials, our farming sheds, buildings right across the country selling into the grid. And that is where the future is in terms of protecting all and not just the brown and blackouts that that Brendan hopefully does not want us to have.
I don't want them.
Hugh, do you want to weigh in on my defence?
Well, no, I suppose I'd make the broader point that, like, you know, one of the issues I think is in terms of offshore, like we're nowhere on that at the moment. And the capacity, or the opportunity is great. But in terms of the planning laws and all of these things that are holding it up and getting offshore wind energy really up and running,
there are planning issues.
There are huge planning issues. The sooner you tackle those bottlenecks, the better we will be in terms of energy independence, and we won't have these companies saying this because they'll be.
Which links back to what we were talking about earlier on with housing. Tech saying, builders tell me they can and want to build more. They need access to more zoned land. That's the message I'm getting from them. They have the capacity to build substantially more homes. Another, my niece wants to buy my 4-bed 1990 semi-D for €375,000 in Galway. The government doesn't offer to help them to do this as it's a second-hand house. Meanwhile, she and her husband are struggling to put a deposit together for a new build in the same area, same house size, for €485,000 and rising. What is going on? Well, if you have a view, 53106 at a cost of 30 cents or 087-1400-106. Big thank you to Maria Walsh, Fine Gael MEP, Brendan Ogle, trade unionist, activist and social commentator, and Hugh O'Connell, freshly minted political editor for the Sunday Times.
The Anton Savage Show with Kiri's.ie on News Talk.